Dan Hochberg is an author and former Defense Department official who leaked the Pentagon Papers. He said, "I would not have thought of copying the Pentagon Papers, risking a possible lifetime in prison without the example of thousands of young Americans who are doing everything they could, including nonviolent disobedience to the draft regulations, to oppose a wrongful, hopeless war. They showed civic courage, and I can attest to its effectiveness. As a government consultant and former official, I felt its power on my life." Daniel Hochberg.
Two very powerful presentations. I identify, of course, very much as a former official myself with the career of Ambassador Murray. I wasn't an ambassador. But in fact, I have never heard a former official who is former for the best of reasons, for the reason I'm speaking out. I've never heard him speak that way. Ever. In fact, I asked the ambassador if he'd ever heard anyone, because I would like him to be aware of how unusual his own behavior is and how much that end he has to contribute to trying to encourage others to emulate. It doesn't happen just automatically. His example is the example to be emulated, but you have to understand, the ambassador, really ask yourself, not only why you did it, which is interesting, and I'm sure you'll be asked that part of it, as I have, but why not the others? Why not anyone? Why not any of your former colleagues? The fact that he's prior is, of course, meant to set a teaching example and to keep him quiet. And it's not surprising to people. A sufficient reason why very few of them ever would speak out the way he has. A problem of our system, the system in general, Kaczynski talks about, which is not exclusive to the United States, of course, by any means, or to this administration. It's not exclusive to this period of history. But I could say a problem that the human species faces in terms of certain patterns of behavior being exhibited now in a nuclear age, which the human species was able to survive for several thousands of years of empire, slavery, torture, class oppression, racism, sexism, etc. Vast numbers of millions of victims in any one generation for these thousands of years, and nevertheless the population was able to grow, spread across the planet, and grow, and empires fell, but other empires rose, and life went on. The threats that are being made now by this president are not the first nuclear threats or threats of aggression that American presidents have ever made. Quite the contrary, virtually every president has made threats, secret threats, I should say threats of initiating nuclear war, generally secretly, of the same kind this president is making right now. But there are two differences. One is they were secret, generally very secret, and there was a reason for that. Up through the Cold War, the American public was very afraid that any given nuclear weapon, especially against an ally of the Soviet Union, people or kind of the Soviet Union, had the potential for blowing the world up, which it did, they were right. Each of these presidents felt that the threat was nevertheless worthwhile, and several of them, including Nixon and others, actually felt and planned that the carrying out of the threat was not as dangerous as the public thought. They knew, for example, that for many of those years, the Soviet Union was enormously less powerful and even a destructive power than the United States. And they really weren't worried about the Soviet Union replying. In fact, their confidence was misplaced in some of those cases, but they weren't worried. So they felt they made the threats, and they prepared to carry them out, and operational plans were made for carrying them out, going back as early as 1953 in Korea, under Eisenhower, and even before that, under Truman. But they were kept secret because they would have worried the public. So what's the other problem? The other problem is that the public, that's reason now, no longer worries with the end of the Cold War that a single weapon or a handful of weapons against the country, even one friendly or a client of Russia, or a traitor of Russia, like Iraq, or the current Iran, both of whom are closer to Russia than they are to the US, for sure, even without being formal allies, but they're no longer afraid that Russia will respond to that weapon with a nuclear response. And I think they're right in that. The likelihood that Russia would respond is, in fact, negligible, except, and this is a real possibility, as a course of escalation that arises out of this that evolves over some time. Unfortunately, our fellow Americans have moved now to an acceptance, not only of the threat, but the carrying out of the initiation of the nuclear war, from a position where, throughout Korea, Vietnam, and other crises, no more than 10%, in a few cases as high as 15%, of the American public would endorse the idea of carrying out a nuclear threat, even to save American soldiers. With the end of the Cold War, that has slipped up to 38% very quickly in the Gulf War. That dismayed me at the time, and that has been true since. Right now, we are being subject to an indoctrination that a nuclear weapon can be used safely in the sense of for technical reasons, against underground sites, underground posts of their nuclear establishment. The public has the impression that that can be done underground without even venting. That is totally false. Such a strike would cause great fallout and essentially surface burst, even if it went down 35 feet, which they're planning. It would kill very, very many people by fallout. But the public, as I say, is not accepting of that. If this president, almost uniquely, is able to make those threats explicitly, the nuclear option is on the table, and when even Democrats, like Nancy Pelosi, were asked, are all options, she said, all options are on the table. She was asked, even nuclear option? All options are on the table. Now, she's talking about an initiation of nuclear war, which the General Assembly has repeatedly described as not only a crime against humanity, Christie's signature of it, but, quote, the gravest crime against humanity and against the peace. And the President of the United States feels free, and is free, to make such threats and make operational plans to carry them out as cyber issues out of the old, without apology, and in fact, probably, he may run on it if he hasn't carried out, I should say, congressional or candidates in November, may well support this, including Democrats. So a challenge is up to us in the gravest of terms. And now, bring this back for a moment to the torture. The torture is, as General Karpinski said, part of a pattern in a number of ways. For one, clearly illegal. Even more clearly illegal in domestic terms and in terms of the UN Charter than the initiation of nuclear war. I'll just assert that. But in just strictly legalistic terms, very clearly illegal, as was our initiation of war against Iraq. And the initiation of non-nuclear war against Iran is clearly illegal under the UN Charter. As a question, we of course ratified and signed the UN Charter, but the President of course boasts of ignoring that piece of paper signed treaty. So that's not going to cause him much political problem. The torture, anti-torture provisions, however, are part of American domestic law, as are the NSA indiscriminate wiretapping, warrantless wiretapping, a clear-cut domestic crime. So in addition to the dangers that are posed by the torture, the effects of that of recruiting Al-Qaeda and recruiting on a massive scale resistance to our presence there. There's pretty resistance anyway on a nationalist level. To the extent that I've studied this, nothing recruits like torture. Nothing. The Shah basically was overthrown because there was hardly a family in Iran that had not had family members tortured by people with the compliance, the complicity, trained by the CIA and others. That made people by the hundreds of thousands willing to demonstrate and for a while be mown down by Shah's troops to protest that, people without minds. Going back now to the Shah was overthrown. Same thing here. It's dangerous, but I don't want to press that point as much. Except the following. There's another issue. We have then both in the wiretaps, which obviously are not as humanly brutal, although they have great implications for democracy, as the torture. But those two things have in common the fact that they've been clear-cut violations of U.S. domestic law, and for the first time in my experience, any country I know of in a democracy, the president has acknowledged belatedly, first he was secret about it, understanding that to admit a violation of law was preferable to keep covered up. But when it was leaked out, when it came out, he acknowledged it. Instead of saying, rogues, notice that in the case of the wiretaps, torture, he did manage to pass it off to other people. In the case of the wiretaps, he proudly announced, yes, I did that, and I'm going to keep doing it. Now again, as in torture, as in other things, this is not actually the first time presidents have done this. In the 60s, Lyndon Johnson was not only CIA and military intelligence, and NSA, with massive illegal surveillance. But it was kept secret for some years, many years after the fight for the Church Committee in 75 and 76. Then the FISA Act, in the case of the wiretaps, was passed with the express purpose of forbidding that, making it clearly illegal in 1978. Imagine if Lyndon Johnson had been found out at the time, 1964, the election campaign, that in the Democratic Convention he was wiretapping and surveilling, bugging every move of Martin Luther King and his lieutenants. That's what he was doing. The bedrooms, the kitchens, everything. Followed around, wiretaps, everything. That was not known for years. Suppose that had come out during the campaign when I was working for him. But imagine beyond that, he had come out and said, yes, I'm doing that. I was advised this was necessary, and I'm going to keep doing it. Think of that for a moment. That is what Bush is, in effect, saying right now. It's a challenge to a constitutional democracy, republic, such as we have not seen in this country. Hitler was mentioned here. And of course, to mention Hitler in America, especially for the older people who know about it, is almost to end discussion. It's regarded as so prejudicial and so extreme that if you were to make any kind of analogy of Hitler in any respect, the conversation is over. You're off the program, you're out of discussion, and so forth. So rhetoric, even when I've often felt that in the case of aggression, for example, the analogy was important. After all, Hitler had committed a number of crimes other than the Holocaust and before the Holocaust, worthy of learning from, and forbidding and not admitting, and hanging people who were in Nuremberg, if you approve of capital punishment. The fact is that I am afraid ever from making this. A reason that I find it now, this year, very hard to refrain from thinking hard and even expressing that analogy of this. I've looked through history and thought about it for examples of a constitutional democracy being subject to a coup by constituted, elected civilian authority who turn a democracy, like the Weimar regime, into a police state in a short period of time, not by military coup, as in Brazil or Chile or Argentina or Indonesia or so many other places where we have sponsored coups, or by revolutionary movements of various kinds that ushered in police states, but by an elected leader who decided he'd want to rule over police state, not as, in Hitler's case, a man who had been elected with 32% of the vote, and then in the last quasi-free election in March of 33, 42% of the vote, all he could get up to, despite having by that time banned the Communist Party and arrested most of the Social Democratic leaders immediately in days following the Reichstag fire of February 27. On February 28, Hitler, with only two ministers in the cabinet at that point, Gerhard being one of them, got Hindenburg to issue a decree the next day. And they'd already banned the Communist Party, and that night they had killed thousands of Communist and Social Democratic leaders and arrested tens of thousands, knowing that the Communists had nothing to do with the Reichstag fire. Nothing. But it was entirely blamed on the Communists. One of the, I think at that point, the third largest party. So they were ruled out of the coming election for March 8. On February 28th, the next day, the decree said suspension of all provisions of the Weimar Constitution on civil liberties. No freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of the press, and one other little provision. Suspension of privacy of the postal system. Now, Gonzalez was asked recently by these very truncated hearings by Aaron Spector about the NSA wiretaps. He wasn't asked by Spector. Spector held a hearing. Somebody else, I think it was Leahy, asked Gonzalez, are you opening mail? And Gonzalez said, not under the program I am testifying about. And Leahy then said, are there other programs that go beyond the FISA Act that are being held right now? He said, I'm not here to testify about that. He refused to testify, sure, pretty clearly, I think, that they're opening mail, you know, among other things. Having learned that he had been listening to emails, tapping all this for NSA, all kinds of electronic communications for 4 years previously, after the first 9/11. He hadn't waited for another 9/11. Or a war for that to happen, which I thought he would. I was talking to a friend in Washington just the other day, actually the guy who helped write the FISA Act. I said, I can't refer to that, but he is opening mail. And my friend said, oh, why did he bother? Who uses mail anymore? Well, I said, maybe a few more people are using mail than they used to, under the impression that it might be a little more secure. I do infer that they're, for what that's worth. The point here is that in the presence of certain powers, both in the civilians and the use of the military for civilians, it's very illegal, unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment, and doing the same under torture. And it's peculiar to think about torture much more than the surveillance, I mean, very much more, is that the human reaction to that in a world that has finally, after thousands of years, come generally to regard torture not as entertainment or the right of the monarch or the basis of state security, but as with revulsion and as unacceptable. In that world, and I'm interested now in finding out how that ever came about, as I see how readily the American public, or half of it, adjusts to going back to torture. But that's an interesting question. How do we ever get away from that? How do the Europeans get away when it doesn't seem that humans have that much resistance to it? But what does occur, for the other half of the people at least, is if you can torture, what can't you do? If you can torture secretly and by president's arbitrary decision, what limits are there? That, as I say, is raised much more sharply than in the case of the wiretapping kind of thing. Well, Harold Poe, the dean of the Yale Law School, drew the conclusion that the logic explaining the legal reason by John Yoo, my old, now back here at Holt Hall, and by David Addington, now chief of staff of Cheney, having been with him for 20 years or more, Biden, who's now a judge in the court, Gonzalez, and Alito, just put on the Supreme Court, named five people there who have assured the President as lawyers that he has inherent powers as Commander-in-Chief, both to violate the FISA law, that hadn't come up when they were written those things, but they pointed, their logic points directly to that, he has those powers, and to torture. Now, as Harold Coe pointed out, Dean of the Yale Law School, if his inherent powers in wartime as Commander-in-Chief allow that, torture being, after all, the ultimate expression of absolute power over individuals. Even in some degree, a significant degree, a human point of view, greater than the ability to execute. Torture is, prolonged torture of various kinds, is worse than death. People who are suffering it long for death. And they're rarely going to tell you 10 years later, 20 years later, how happy they are that they lived through that instead of being killed. Torture, the kinds we've heard, if the president or the leader has the right to do that, the power to use that, then he has unlimited power. So Harold Cole pointed out, if the president has that inherent power, he has the power to order and carry out genocide, massacre, to reinstitute slavery, cannibalism, or whatever. There really is no limit. Now, that's not just a hypothetical chain of logic, we call it. The fact is that what these lawyers, including the new Supreme Court justice, presumably Roberts, too, who wasn't pressed on it, but Alito definitely, and the Attorney General, Harold Gonzales, have stated essentially in so many words, there is no limit of any kind, not just the UN Charter, you know, President, you know, hosts of disregarding the Constitution, which privately he has referred to as just a piece of paper. He hasn't said that publicly. Domestic law, legislation, he has literally no restraint on him to doing anything. Now, it isn't just torture alone that follows from that, bad enough as that is. When I said he has the power to commit genocide, every president we've had since Harry Truman, I should say, since Eisenhower, when the H-bomb came in, has believed he had the power to genocide, to threaten, prepare, and if necessary, order our armed forces to carry out not just genocide on the Soviet Union, homicide, multi-genocide, ethnic group, racial groups, everything. Hundreds of millions of people, hundreds of millions. I have seen the plans for that. I have PSYOP access. Similar great operation plan, general war plan, plans for genocide. We're not planning now hundreds of millions to kill in Iran. It would probably be just millions. But that's already a massacre of genocide, very obviously, and it leads us on a path. No president has ever been challenged on his, by anyone in Congress, on his right to do that without warning to Congress or any consent by Congress, any regulation whatever, when he chose to do it. No restraint has ever been put on any president. We are using our weapons right now. The way you use a gun when you point it at somebody's head, whether or not you pull the trigger. If you get your way without pulling the trigger, that's the best use you could get. And that's why presidents get their weapons, to use them that way. And we are setting an example now to every country in the world. With the end of the Cold War, without the pretense that our survival is threatened, that we, the richest, strongest country in the world, with military alternatives to nuclear weapons, outnumbering, outscale all the rest of the world combined, we have the right and necessity to initiate nuclear war against the non-nuclear state. We are, in other words, promoting proliferation in a very drastic way. I want to make one last point to put this in context. I think this drew out this willingness on the U.S. part to make such threats and support them. And other countries have been imitating us now, and we're pretty willing to imitate us more, by our policy was adopted secretly in World War II by the British first, and the Americans, of strategic bombing, or what Churchill called terror bombing, area bombing, in which civilians were explicitly the target for firebombing, not starting in Dresden. The Americans were involved in Hamburg in 1943 by the firestorm. In Dresden, it wasn't just British, but it was British, but it wasn't just British. The Americans came in the second day. I should say the morning after the firestorm had killed. The most realistic estimate now is something like 38 or 40,000 people, or bigger estimates have been made. Shortly after that, the U.S. carried out the largest massacre in human history, the largest act of terror on a single day in human history. How many people here are familiar with what happened on the night of March 9th, 10th, 9th and 10th, 1945? How many people know what I'm talking about? Does he have? How many do not? And I said, okay, well, most, more do than I would have expected. But those who do know, that was the night that we burned alive between 80 and 120,000 civilians in Tokyo. And what reminded me of it tonight, I'm sorry to say, in a kind of way, we've heard these horrifying descriptions, horrified by Ambassador Murray, of this absolute power by Uzbekistan on a number of individuals. In fact, you mentioned two, but presumably there were a lot more. One little fact about the firebombing of Tokyo that always impressed me when I read it. Most of the deaths were by suffocation of the oxygen being burned up by the firestorm. People died in shelters and in basements. But those who escaped those went onto the streets trying to get to the canals. However, they found that the asphalt was melted and burning. So many of them burned like candles with their feet stuck in the asphalt. But those who got to the canals that crisscrossed Tokyo, like Venice, jumped into canals to escape the firestorm. But the canals were boiling, and tens of thousands boiled in the canals. Doing that for 5 months before Hiroshima, steadily every day, killed an estimated 800,000 civilians, mostly women and children, men are off war outside Japan. Babies burned to death. In that context, of course, torture alone seems almost trivial. But of course, it's the same, it's on the same pattern. And after that, of course, the atom bomb that presented to President Truman no moral problem. Quite rightly, that's what he said. I felt no moral problem. Very understandably, his predecessor, FDR, had authorized and carried out killing by fire as many Japanese children, infants, babies, in front of their families. And those who didn't die were burned for life. Lost arms, limbs, whatever. If you were doing that as much as you could for 5 months, doing it with one bomb in a night, killing less people, perhaps 80,000 in Hiroshima, 48,000 in Nagasaki, Tokyo may have killed more than both of those together in immediate effects in one night. So there's no moral problem, we were just doing it more efficiently. We have now arrived at the point where that ability to destroy cities with a single bomb, now it's metropolitan areas, the big ones, has passed directly to 8 or 9 countries, depending on how you count. Strictly speaking, India and Pakistan have not yet succeeded in producing an H-bomb, which increases the thermal effects, the fire effects, vastly. But they will if the U.S. renews testing, which I believe this administration intends to do and will do with the next 9/11 or the wake of an Iranian case. They'll get each month. And then all the nuclear powers will get each month. Israel is doing it right now, which does make a difference in terms of genocide and on the side, and then other countries will get them too. What we're talking then about is human values, not invented in this generation, but human values that have been expressed in war, the killing of civilians for a long time, but made technically feasible on a scale that was never before seen for just two countries, UK and America. For a while, before the Avon, only those two countries could destroy a city by air. With the Avon, anybody with an Avon could do it. It's a difference. We weren't subject to any threat like that before that. And the British were, because they were close enough to Germany. But with our oceans, we weren't subject. By promoting proliferation all those years, we have made ourselves vulnerable. Soon it will be many other countries. And these Avons and H-bombs will be in the hands of humans of the kind that have supported torture all these years and have been in war and aggression, except that some have gotten away from it a little bit. And the second part is that, so I would say this is a species not to be trusted with nuclear weapons. But beyond that, this is a superpower right now with a president who believes from legal advice that he already has the powers that Hitler assumed with emergency decrees only after the Reichstag fire, and then when he was voted emergency powers in late March, and by June that there was a one-party state. We have, in other words, convergent crises right now toward democracy and to world order in terms of aggression in Iran. It is up to us. Our leaders have almost unanimously failed to show us any kind of civil courage in terms of speaking out to be saw an ambassador. By the way, we did have one person of ambassadorial rank, Anne Wright, who was in Mongolia, who resigned just before the chairman, working with her a lot to continue to register West Country in Crawford, Texas. There was two other, John David Keaton and John Brown, who resigned and has spoken out. I did ask Anne Wright why she didn't take a lot of secrets with her and put them out, but she did. She said, we didn't get a lot of interesting cables in Mongolia. She wouldn't. Unless officials can identify with the position, although there are many who understand they're in the same position, as General Karpinski, Ambassador Merkel. You can see that inside. Sidehurst tells us that they are appalled by the nuclear planning they are doing, and some of them are thinking of resigning. When I saw that, my thought was, resign when? After the bomb? Or before? And if before, what good will that do? Nothing. It will save no lives. No lives. Before or after. Don't resign. Leak. Disclose documents on a large scale, current documents. Don't do what I did. Wait till the bombs have fallen. Wait till new wars have started in Iran or elsewhere. Wait till, if you like, the torture has been extended to the detention camps being constructed in this country right now for the nation by KBR for Halliburton. Don't wait for all of the detention camps to be filled and the torture to come back from Abu Ghraib to where I'm sure we have a lot of it in our prisons right now, but mostly for black, poor, very poor people. And the torture will now spread as these things have attended to Middle Easterners and then to people like those in this audience. It is disgraceful that John Yoo is able in Bhopal here to put out these theories, to put out books and so forth, without, it's fine that he can say them, that's our country, that's the First Amendment, but that he says them without challenge by other members of the faculty or by students. I spoke at one that I'm sure I'll just close with this. It was announced that I spoke at the first vigil here against torture outside Bolt Hall. in theory, other class that they thought you was in, but it turned out he wasn't at the moment. There were zero students in about the 17 people who attended that ritual. How many students, aside from the people with the Constitution summer group that I applaud very much, a terrific group, aside from those, how many students are here tonight? Can I see your hands up? Oh, that's sort of more than I thought. Congratulations. I thank you for being here. I actually was expecting about five hands after zero at those vigils, and I was prepared to say pretty pitiful showing for the student body as a whole, but actually that's a decent showing for this, and enough of you to spread the word to your fellow students. They and we are living with a challenge to the democracy that they grew up in so far, with all its limitations. But anybody who thinks that the Patriot Act is the last word in the abridgment of our freedoms is not being realistic. We have to live up, it's up to us to press our so-called leaders in Congress and elsewhere to act on their oaths to obey the Constitution, not the Fuhrer.